For what's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, backed by Turkish artillery, are claiming major advances against Islamic State extremists outside Iraq's second biggest city, Mosul, at one point claiming to have seized full control of the town of Bashik. It lies about 10 kilometers northeast of Mosul. In the village of Safira, about 30 kilometers to the south, Iraqi federal police fired mortars and rockets at suspected IS targets. Iraqi Brigadier Nijim al-Jabour, who is leading that operation, said morale is high.
ISIS collapse. ISIS now, their morale very down. You can read in the faces of the soldiers and the civilian with us, their morale very high. I think this the end of ISIS.
Safira is among dozens of villages taken from IS militants since the start of the Mosul campaign a week ago. A group of 26 Asian sailors was freed from nearly 5 years' captivity by Somali pirates. They arrived Sunday in Kenya. They were seized when their Omani-flagged fishing vessel was overtaken close to the Seychelles in March of 2012. The captives were handed over in the Somali town of Galkayo Saturday. John Steed is a coordinator with the group Oceans Beyond Piracy.
As with any negotiation, you try and find the right people to negotiate with. And we've achieved what we've achieved today by getting tribal elders, religious leaders, and the local community and the regional government all involved to put pressure on these guys to release these hostages. 4.5 years is, you know, unreasonable. It's just not right.
A $1.5 million ransom was reportedly paid for the release of the sailors, but that could not be independently verified. This is VOA News. Fighting returned Sunday to the besieged Syrian city of Aleppo after a 3-day humanitarian pause announced by Russia, allowing the exodus of rebel fighters, the sick and wounded. It appears few took up the offer to leave the rebel-held sector of the city. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported airstrikes, ground offensives, and shelling with at least 3 civilians killed. Lithuanians voted for major change in a second round of parliamentary elections Sunday, handing victory to a center-right farmers' union that previously held only 1 seat in parliament. The Peasants and Green Union Party, led by $46 million millionaire farmer Ramūnas Karbauskas, is expected to end up with 54 seats in the 141-member parliament. It's the biggest victory by a single party there in 20 years. Karbauskas said his party will engage in negotiations with other parties on Monday about forming a coalition government. Lithuania has experienced sluggish economic growth, currently at an annual rate of just 2-3%, less than half of what was 10 years ago, as well as a labor exodus. The Peasants and Green Union Party has promised a technocratic government focused on economic growth. French officials are expected to use buses Monday to transport thousands of migrants to reception centers, destroy a makeshift refugee camp near the northern port city of Calais that has become known as the jungle. The relocation expected to take about a week. The Hudson Institute's Ben Haddad said the migration issue has become a political hot-button issue in France.
It's become very heated because in the context of a broader refugee crisis and the issues of migration and the rise of populism all over Europe, this has become very political in the town of Calais, which is a post-industrial city in north of France, struggling with high unemployment, where Marine Le Pen's National Front, the whole region is polling very highly. So it's become a very tense political issue.
Some migrants may refuse to go because they still want to get to Britain across the English Channel. Spain's socialists have decided to stop blocking the rival Popular Party from forming a minority government, bringing to an end the country's nearly 10-month political impasse. The vote effectively grants Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy a second term in office. In South Africa, a senior member of the ruling African National Congress, Jackson Mthembu, the parliamentary whip, is calling on the ANC's top leadership, including President Jacob Zuma, to quit. He said fraud charges against Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan, along with the party's poor showing in August municipal elections, as well as party factionalism, motivated his decision. At least 13 killed, more than 30 injured in a tour bus crash in Southern California. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, October 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopia criticizes the United States for its travel warning on Ethiopia.
What I find absolutely intriguing about the statement of the State Department is that they seem to resent the fact that we have come back to normalcy.
Getachew Reda is Ethiopia's communications minister. Today is World Polio Day, and Nigeria says it is on track to be free of polio in the coming year. Political crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo is adding misery to that country's economic woes. And Zambia is commemorating 54 years of independence today, Monday.
There will be celebrations all over the country, in every district, in every province, but the main celebration will be at Levi Mwanawasa Stadium, where the guest of honor would be the Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni.
Chishimba Kambwile is Zambia's Minister of Information. Meanwhile, the main opposition UPND says Zambians have nothing to celebrate in the face of lack of freedom of expression, association, and economic doom. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Ethiopian government says it is disappointed in the State Department's announcement of a travel warning about Ethiopia. The State Department warned U.S. citizens on Friday to defer all non-essential travel to Ethiopia due to what it called ongoing unrest that has led to hundreds of deaths, thousands of arrests, as well as injuries and extensive property damage, especially in Amhara and Oromia states. The Ethiopian government earlier this month announced a six-month state of emergency to address security challenges in the face of deadly anti-government protests across the country. Communications Minister Getachew Reda says the state of emergency is having its desired effect as it has brought the country to normalcy. He said it appears there are some within the State Department who resent the fact that Ethiopia has returned to some normalcy.
The state of emergency is obviously proving its mettle. The country is back to normalcy. And of course, people who've been terrorized into submission by armed gangs are now making it clear that they won't stand idly by while these gangs terrorize their villages and towns. Even those who were in the business of making all kinds of bad things to the people are now coming to terms with the fact that they have to hand themselves over.
You indicated that you were going to provide some evidence. Do you still have that evidence, and have you made new that evidence?
When we say we will provide evidence, it means we have evidence, okay?
Do you think the public needs to know the evidence?
Well, we'll provide evidence when and if it's necessary. And I don't think this is the stuff of VOA interviews or something.
Okay, what do you make of the State Department declaring a travel restriction to your country?
Well, it's quite unfortunate that people in the State Department had to make a strenuous effort to come up with an absolutely ridiculous reason to impose sort of a travel advisory. I wouldn't call it travel ban, but it sounds as if someone in the State Department was worried that the situation is coming back to normalcy. Because if you read the first paragraph in the travel advisory, it would have you believe that because of ongoing unrest in the country, there is no ongoing unrest in this country. Unfortunately, it took this state of emergency for things to come back to normal, but the State Department statement seems to suggest that unrest still goes on in the country, which is far from the reality on the ground. And obviously, someone in the State Department seems to have resented the fact that things have gone back to normal sooner than they expected, probably.
The advisory said that internet cellular data and phone services have been periodically restricted or shut down throughout Ethiopia, which has impeded U.S. Embassy's ability to communicate with its citizens.
Yes, that's partly true. But I don't think the U.S. Embassy in Addis Ababa requires that kind of active communication to address whatever challenge faced by American citizens throughout Ethiopia. Like I said, you know, there have been measures by the government to limit communications in internet, telephone, whatever communications in some parts of the country based on actual need on the ground. But for the State Department or the U.S. Embassy to claim that it has difficulties extending support to its citizens is an overstatement at best or an absolute fiction at the worst.
Were you saying that you feel that maybe someone in the State Department does not want the state of emergency to be working as it is working now?
Well, obviously, I mean, they still think unrest is going on in the country. There is no unrest in the country unless someone in their imagination still continue to dream that unrest up. Well, I'm not particularly crazy about the fact that people are enjoying the fact that the state of emergency has brought about normalcy in this region. What I find absolutely intriguing about the statement of the State Department is that they seem to resent the fact that we have come back to normalcy in a very short period of time. And, well, I don't think this is the official position of the government of the United States, but again, it's not for me to decide what the official position of the government of the United States is.
So what do you make of people who say the state of emergency restricts the movement of people, Ethiopians and also opposition people?
No. It does restrict some movements in some parts of the country. And of course, it's very explicit. It doesn't shy away from telling people that there are some areas which are off limits to foreigners, to Ethiopians, to criminals, whatever. I mean, it gives you specifics as to where you can go, as to where you can't. Otherwise, this is the kind of emergency declaration you would expect. I mean, in the United States, after September 11, you have the Patriot Act. I mean, there are certain things which specifically prohibit certain groups of people from doing this and that. I don't think the Chinese government or the Russian government has come up with travel advisory on the basis of the Patriot Act.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Jim.
Getachew Reda is Ethiopia's communications minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Addis Ababa. Zambia is today, Monday, observing the 54th anniversary of its independence from Great Britain. Information Minister Chishimba Kambwile says that President Edgar Lungu, who was re-elected in August this year, has articulated a recovery program which includes diversification of the economy from dependence on copper mining to agriculture. He says opposition politicians who criticize the state of the country are simply playing the blame game. Kabwile says that there will be celebrations all over Zambia today with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni as guest of honor for the main celebration in Lusaka.
There will be celebrations all over the country, in every district, in every province, but the main celebration will be at Levi Mwanawasa Stadium, where the guest of honor would be the Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni.
So what can you tell Zambians, or what do you think the president will say? Do you think he's going to say that Zambia is on the right track after the election?
Certainly. The president has spelled out his program of how he wants Zambia to run from now going forward. And I think the most important thing is the diversification of the economy from dependence on copper mining to agriculture.
But the opposition say that the economy is doing very poorly. If I may use the words of one of the critics, is that the economy is on its knees.
You and I know that the entire world economies are not doing very well. And Zambia is not an exception. This time the world is a global village. Like I've said, Zambia depends on the export of copper. 90% of the budget depends on the earnings from the copper industry. And now there is a slowdown in the Chinese economy, who are the major consumers of our copper. There is a slowdown in the euro economy. How do you expect Zambia to survive? And to diversify the economy, it cannot take you 1 year or 2 years. So it needs everybody, opposition, the ruling government, and all the Zambians to work together to diversify the economy. Zambia has grown its economy by 7%, 6%, 5%, 5.7%, and 3% in 2015. And it is emphasized that we are going to grow the economy this year by about 3.5%, 2016. And when you look at the general growth of the world economy, it's about 2%. So we are above the average of the world economical growth. So where is the economy on its knees? So if the opposition are complaining that the economy is not doing all right, I would invite them to read, check out other economies, how they are doing, and then they'll realize that Zambia cannot be a standalone economy because the world is a global village.
I want you to talk about what some people are saying is the high price of fuel, to the point that some Zambians, we understand, are crossing into Botswana to buy fuel because the price in Zambia is high.
You know the price of fuel in England. You know the price of fuel in America. You know the price of fuel everywhere. The price of fuel in Zambia now is about $1.20, which is almost the price of everybody in the world, which is the average price of fuel in all economies. The Botswana's price is about 8 pula, 70 cents. Now, what we've done as government is that we are spending a lot of money to subsidize fuel importation, and this has made other sectors of the economy to suffer. So what we have simply done as government is to remove the subsidies from the importation of fuel, whereas our friends in Botswana are able to continue with the subsidies. Now, because they've continued with the subsidies, their fuel is slightly cheaper than the price in Zambia. But governance is not a small issue. You have to balance all the angles. We have to look at social sector. We have to look at the fuel. We have to look at medicines in hospitals. So what we are doing is in the best interest of providing services to the people of Zambia.
Chishimba Kambwile is Zambia's Minister of Information. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Today is Monday, October 24th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 and a half minutes past the hour as Zambia commemorates 54 years of independence today, Monday. The main opposition, United Party for National Development, UPND, says there's nothing to celebrate in the face of lack of freedom of expression, freedom of association, and it doomed a country economically, including rising fuel prices. Charles Kakoma is spokesman for the opposition, UPND.
A lot of people feel that this current government has laid them down. There's nothing to celebrate about. We fought for independence so that we can liberate ourselves from oppression, from the suppression of their human rights and freedoms. But it's like 52 years down the line, we are back to the colonial days where people still have to fight for our rights to assembly, to association, to free speech, and so on. So there's nothing to inspire them to celebrate. For example, in terms of freedom of expression, people are not free to express themselves. Those that have tried to express themselves have been arrested. The government has closed down media institutions. Newspapers have been closed down, including the leading newspaper in Zambia, the Post newspaper, have been closed down. Community radio stations have been closed down, because they were hosting divergent views from the public. So freedom of expression has been tempered with. In terms of freedom of association, the opposition in Zambia is no longer free to hold meetings, to hold rallies. Each time they try to do that, they are being arrested by the police. A lot of people are in detention. The estimate now is more than 2,000 people are in detention because of trying to enjoy the freedoms of association. So a lot of people think that it's not worth celebrating.
As someone outside of Zambia listening to you, one would think everything is gloomy, but Zambia just had a multi-party election. So isn't that something to be proud of also?
Well, the election is disputed and the matter is in court. The UPND took the matter to court because the UPND felt that the election was stolen from them. And our right to be heard in the election petition was denied. And therefore, we think that this government is not legitimately elected. So from the democratic point of view, it is a stalemate. Economically, it is gloomy. The Minister of Finance, the new Minister of Finance, was just in Parliament last week and confirmed the gloomy picture. that we're headed for doom, and we've basically failed to run this economy, and they've now invited the International Monetary Fund to come and bail us out. So economically, there's nothing to celebrate about, because we know that with the IMF program, conditions of living will worsen in Zambia, probably like a structural adjustment program, which will see employment being frozen for some time, and of course, wage increments being frozen, people being laid off, the public services jobs. It will be tough. It will be tough for the poorest of the poor. Inflation is going up. Just recently, last week, they increased the fuel prices, and they're expecting a steep increase in electricity tariffs. And with the cutting of subsidies on agriculture, and the majority of the people in Zambia are small-scale farmers that depend on the government-subsidized fertilizer, it is going to be hard for the majority of the people in Zambia. So economically, there's nothing to celebrate.
Charles Kakoma is spokesman for the opposition UPND Party of Zambia. He was speaking with me from Lusaka. The Democratic Republic of Congo has delayed the presidential elections slated for next month by nearly 2 years. The United Nations has warned that tensions could lead to more violence, and the political crisis certainly has not helped the already struggling economy. Emily Yob reports from Kinshasa.
The normally bustling streets of capital Kinshasa are empty. It's October 19th, and the opposition has called a general strike to press President Joseph Kabila to step down at the end of his second mandate in December. But some, like charcoal trader Mireille Samba, simply can't afford politics.
I agree with the idea of the strike. It teaches the authorities to listen to the people. But I had to go to work today because there is no food at home. If I had not, my children would have gone hungry today, so I came out, despite the risks, to try to sell a little.
More than half of Congolese live below the poverty line, and the political impasse is not helping an already weakened economy. The global slump in commodity prices has hit Africa's biggest copper producer. The local currency, the Congolese franc, has slid significantly against the dollar, officially by more than 10% this year, but as much as 25% on the black market.
When the local currency loses value, it means that most of the imported goods will cost more, and that will impact people's purchasing power.
At Kinshasa's main market, traders have had to raise prices.
This is bad for everyone. You see us now at 3 p.m. already packing up and going home. It is because there are no customers.
Political headquarters in Kinshasa still bear the scars of violent protests last month that killed over 50 people, according to right groups. Continued unrest could deter foreign investors. Foreign investment drove the country's surge in GDP growth prior to 2015.
If all the political parties find an agreement, it will be okay. But if they do not, it will affect the economy and impact inflation.
The path to consensus looks cloudier than ever. The majority of the opposition has rejected an agreement signed this week. That deal keeps Kabila in office until elections, now pushed to April 2018. Emilia for VOA News in Kinshasa.
Today, Monday, is World Polio Day, established over a decade ago by Rotary International to commemorate the birth of Jonas Salk, who led the first team to develop a vaccine against the disease. Professor Isaac Adewole, Nigeria's Minister of Health, says the government is on track to making Nigeria free of polio in the coming year, thereby also contributing to Africa being free of the disease. But the discovery of 4 new cases, particularly in the north of the country, has returned Nigeria to the list of polio-endemic countries. Professor Adewole says the government will leave no stone unturned to ensure that every child under the age of 5 is immunized against polio. And Professor Adewole says the only challenge now is the availability of vaccine.
As you might be aware, Nigeria was actually certified free of polio for 2 years before we picked a case in July, another case towards the end of July, and one case in August and one case in September. So far, we have 4 cases of white polio, which we detected through our effective surveillance measures, particularly among children just being liberated from areas under the control of the insurgents. This is not unexpected because we're dealing with a population that had no access to appropriate health care over the last 4 to 5 years. And because of this, right from the time that we picked the first case, we declared the public health emergency. We decided to work with not only WHO and other international partners like Polio International, Bill and Melinda Gates, USAID, all our friends. And we also network with neighboring countries in Niger, Chad, Central African Republic, as well as Cameroon, to declare the discovery of white polio as a public health emergency for the region. We have since then mounted a robust immunization response in a ring fashion. We plan to do 6 rounds of immunization. We have done 3. We are about to start the 4th one. With the first one, we immunized over 800,000 children in the affected area. We then move on to 1st adjoining states. We have covered 18 states. We went back to the 4 states, and then we want to move on to another 18 states. I think so far we're on track. The only challenge we have is the availability of the vaccines. As we have vaccines, we will keep on expanding the scope of the coverage.
Mr. Minister, you mentioned how Nigeria was declared polio-free, and then emerging, are we talking a Borno State area or in the northeast of the country where, for example, the insurgency is going on?
It's actually Borno State, but more specifically, we're dealing with Goza, which is on the border with Cameroon. We are dealing with Muna Camp. We are dealing with Monguno. These are areas. Monguno is one of the largest IDP camps where we have people just released from the insurgency held areas are actually kept. So these are people who have had no access to medical care over the last 4 to 5 years.
But the difficulty is getting the vaccine. Are you cooperating or getting some help, say, from the World Health Organization?
We are getting help from World Health Organization, Bill and Melinda Gates, and Polio International. All our friends are supporting us in this effort, including UNICEF.
So, Minister, on this day again, what message do you want to send to the country and to the people?
The message to the people is for them to be aware of government effort, to be rest assured that we are not going to leave any stone unturned to ensure that every child under the age of 5 is immunized against polio, and that we intend to keep Nigeria free of polio in 2017 and thereby contribute to Africa being free from polio.
Minister, it's so nice to talk with you, and thank you very much again for joining us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Professor Isaac Adewole is Nigeria's health minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A car bomb exploded outside a tire shop in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, on Sunday, killing at least 3 people and injuring 4 others, witnesses and officials said. A VOA reporter said the driver, a suspected Al-Shabaab suicide attacker, is among the dead. A journalist with Dasan radio station in Mogadishu, which is located near the explosion site, said he heard a huge blast and then saw smoke and flame emerge. Doctors at Medea Hospital in the capital have confirmed that 4 injured people were admitted at their facility. That is it for this Monday, October 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barty in Washington saying, have a productive week.
Next on Let's Talk, many find women indistinguishable from men on key leadership traits such as intelligence and capacity for innovation. Do you agree with that? Well, join host Sunday Shomari and his guest as they discuss women in leadership. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 1730 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll look at the role of the Washington, D.C. Mayor's Office of African Affairs. We'll discuss the impact of the office as it seeks to improve the quality of life for the District of Columbia's diverse African-born population. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world.
You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.